I don't think we've ever seen anything like this before.
Two brothers.
Harley's got all the facts tonight. Jasper is a trivia weapon. Get out of his way.
A bunch of trivia questions.
Trivia is cool, and that makes these guys two cool guys.
Everything's on the line in today's episode of
How Do They Keep Getting It Right?
Trivia Champ or Trivia Chump?
Giddy up, it's trivia time. Welcome to Trivia Champ or Trivia Chump. My name is Jasper. This is our brand new pub trivia podcast. And joining me is my brother and co-host, Harley.
How are ya?
Going great, mate. Do you have a fun fact for us to kick the day off?
I do. I've just returned from gallivanting around the world. Mm. And I was intrigued to learn that there is a building in Miami. It's at one point the Pan Am seaplane base connecting all of Latin America with Miami. And later on, for 58 years, was the government headquarters for the city of Miami.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, is the building there now? Like, what's
it is. Yeah, yeah.
So you can go visit?
You can. I didn't, but you can.
Wow. Okay.
I've spent my time, you know, doing much more culturally appropriate things, like going to Chick-fil-A.
And live in La Vida Loca, as the locals would absolutely say. Is Ricky Martin from Miami?
No, he's Puerto Rican, I think.
Oh, really? Okay. I reckon we should just crack straight into it. Let's hear the rules and we'll get underway.
Mate, there's been 24 years of no trivia podcast. Let's just get straight into it.
I think en masse, like, this is the first day of many thousands of days we haven't done a trivia podcast. So there's no time to waste. Precisely. Let's get cracking.
Harley and Jasper have nominated three special subjects to be quizzed on by the other person. The three special subject rounds will feature five questions for each contestant. The trivia champ will be the person who answers the most questions correctly by the end of the game.
Okay, so round one, this is our first round. Harley, you're going to be hearing questions about outdated transport options.
Mm-hmm.
What motivated this as your choice?
Well, as everyone will find out listening, I'm something of an aeroplane nerd and generally a bit of a machinery nerd. So, you know, I thought that would be fun. And I was on my trip and it was sort of, I wrote down a list of things all at once and that happened to be the top of them.
Fantastic. Yeah. And excellent. What will my topic for the first round be?
Yours is formally known as.
That's intriguing. I kind of like that there was maybe a few different angles you can come at that from. You could ask about science. You could ask about maybe literature. There's a lot going on.
All of mine are about planes.
Okay. Awesome. Can't wait. It sounds good.
Round one.
All right, Harley. Round one for you. Question one in outdated transport options. Question one. Which city hosted the equestrian events for the 1956 Melbourne Summer Olympics? Australia required horses to quarantine for 6 months prior to arrival in the country, so this far-flung destination substituted in and held the events 5 months before the Olympics opened in Melbourne that November.
I know this.
Do you really?
I do, yeah. And this, I think there were some pretty amazing feats and like records broken in this, and I just so happen to know that it was actually Stockholm, Sweden, wasn't it?
You're on the board with 1 point already. That's correct. It was in Stockholm, which, to be honest, could not really be much further from Melbourne if it tried, could it?
Like they didn't even go for like a vaguely climatically similar place.
Right? Despite negotiations, the Australian government, led at the time by Prime Minister Robert Menzies, decided they would not relax rules for the Olympics, and Stockholm beat out Paris, Rio de Janeiro, Los Angeles, and Berlin to host the equestrian events.
Wait, so there were like places like vying to have the scraps of Melbourne?
No, they all wanted to do it. Yeah.
Wow.
But that's what I mean. Like LA, probably. Well, I guess LA is kind of a bit warmer than Melbourne. But Rio would have been interesting because that would have been the first time anything Olympics related was on South America, I'm pretty sure.
Mm, well, because the Rio Olympics were the first South American Olympics period, weren't they?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're on the board. Well done. Question one. Correct. Question two.
Mm-hmm.
Staying with the sporting theme here. The Iditarod is the world's most famous dog sled race, run yearly between the Alaskan towns of Anchorage and Nome, crossing frozen waterways and two mountain ranges over 1,510 kilometres. In the 50 years since its inception, an American musher, that's the word used for like the driver, an American musher has won the race 42 times. From three guesses, name one of the other two wintry countries that have had a musher win the race.
So two guesses.
Yeah, I'm going to give you two guesses.
Three guesses,
to name one of the two. So I'm being pretty generous here.
Wow, okay.
All you need to do is name one.
Like, I'd be so tempted to say Russia, but I wouldn't think you'd give me so many guesses if it was somewhere like Russia. I'm going to guess that, well, I mean, but 50 years, Russia wouldn't have been able to go into it for like 25 of those, hey?
I'm not. I can't give anything away. Yeah. You're already off to a flyer, mate. So
I want to say, because I know that something's leading me towards more Scandinavian countries than Russia. Because like one guess would have sufficed for Russia. You're playing mind games with me if it's Russia. I'm going to say Finland as a guess.
Okay.
I reckon the Swedes have got a lot of sort of outback. Like permafrosty kind of...
backcountry sort of.
Yeah, backcountry. Yep. And I'll go somewhere a bit out of left field for the last one. I reckon maybe Argentina.
Okay.
No, actually Chile. They've got Patagonia. I'm going to go Chile.
So just to confirm, your three guesses are...
Finland.
Sweden.
And Chile.
Chile. Mate, you're very much along the right lines of Scandinavia. One of the countries is Norway.
No.
Yep. And the other country, you didn't think to go Canada? It's not Canada.
Oh,
it's
really...
Switzerland.
Okay.
Norway and Switzerland. So I'll just give you a little breakdown here. Martin Bucer of Switzerland won the event four times. Big Marty won it 1992 and... Oh, sorry. He won it four times between 1992 and 2002. The equal second most time someone has won it. So that's pretty remarkable. Marty, if you're listening, you have our respect.
Yep.
He broke the record for the fastest completion of the race in 1992 with his time of 10 days, 19 hours, 17 minutes and 15 seconds, but that has since been bested numerous times. And three different Norwegians have won the race. Robert Sawley, Thomas Werner, and... let's have a go. Jor Leifseth Olsen.
Okay.
I'm so sorry, Jor, if you're listening. Possibly you won't even know that you're the person being referred to there because that's likely not how it's pronounced.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid, mate, you came very close there. Oh, but the answers were Switzerland and Norway.
Okay.
How are you feeling after that?
Gutted.
Just try and contain your disappointment for question three, okay?
Okay.
Television personality Conan O'Brien was inspired to write an iconic 1993 television episode when he looked out his window while driving in Los Angeles and saw a billboard with what one word written on it?
Well, it'll be a Simpsons episode.
Okay.
What year did you say?
1993.
And it was a one word billboard in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and I would say, just remember what your category is here.
Outdated. Oh, I get it now. Yeah. I don't know why you just have a billboard that says monorail, but I mean, the monorail episode is about that era of Simpsons, and I think Conan O'Brien wrote that episode. So I'm going to say monorail.
You know, a trivia podcast without Simpsons questions is a little like a mule with a spinning wheel.
Nobody knows how he got it,
and damned if he knows how to use it. Yeah, it's correct. O'Brien worked on The Simpsons between 1991 and 1993 and has writing credits on the episodes Marge vs. the Monorail, Homer Goes to College, New Kid on the Block, and Treehouse of Horror 4.
There you go.
So you've done pretty well here, mate. You're on 2 out of 3 as we head into question 4.
Okay.
Question 4. The Horses became a hit for Australian singer Darryl Braithwaite in 1991, 2 years after American country singer Ricky Lee Jones co-wrote it for her album Flying Cowboys. Jones's version was never released as a single, but achieved some popularity for appearing in which Oscar-winning 1996 film that has two quotes in the American Film Institute's Top 100 Movie Quotes list?
1996
film that's got some iconic quotes in it that had the original version of Horses on its soundtrack.
You know what movie that I know has got two quotes in it? In that list and came out about then is?
Yeah.
I don't know why The Horses as a country song would be in it, but I know Jerry Maguire has two, and there you had me at Hello and Show Me the Money.
Yep.
And I feel good about that because, as you know, on my trip, I actually had a bit of an encounter and a meeting with Cuba Gooding Jr. when I was at a bar.
Yeah, so, can you just talk us through, because you've only gone back a couple of days ago, and yep. I feel like I haven't quite heard the full story here. So can you just tell us a little bit about your meeting with Mr. Gooding Jr.?
So I decided to go out to a bar in Miami just by myself because I like drinking alone. And
okay, let's move past that. Yep.
And I was talking to the people next to me, and a girl went up to this guy sitting like across the bar, like two or three meters away, and got a photo with him. And I kind of went, that's funny. And we looked at him, and I didn't really get a good look at him, and the guy next to me said, oh, he's an actor. And I tilted my head and I looked and I went, And, you know, I was something somewhat inebriated at this point. I'd kind of met the person next to me.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, that's Cuba Gooding Jr., which I'm lucky I was correct about because the guy next to me started being very confident that it was. And we went and got a photo with him and, you know, had a brief chat. Seemed like quite an interesting guy and engaging in conversation and everything. But I know it came out about then. And I was, like, I was looking up Cuba Gooding Jr. things since then. And I know two quotes in that make that list. So I'm going to go Jerry Maguire.
That's the correct answer. Well done, Jerry Maguire. 3 for 4. You don't going very well here.
Awesome. Yeah,
I think when you're an Australian in America, you have, like, you can cash that chip in pretty hard. Like, I think Americans do really like Australians. Was he talking to you about Australia?
Yeah, he was. He was telling me he'd been to Perth, Melbourne, and Sydney for work, but he would like to go sort of just for leisure.
Yeah.
And he was telling me about some sort of Australian film, but like by the time I was talking to him, I was, you know, I'd had a few drinks and I wasn't sort of in a frame of mind to have a serious conversation.
Yeah, he was talking about his favourite movie of all time, Crackerjack, starring Mick Malloy.
It was something really out of left field. I'd never heard of it.
Do you think maybe Australian cinema, if you're an American movie person, is a little bit like... Bit art house, fine wine. Like, oh yeah, I was actually at Sinbad watching Crackerjack. You've probably never heard of it.
Yeah, I was watching... Bad Eggs. I was watching Maybe. You Can't Stop the Murders.
Ooh, that's some good movies coming out here. Yeah, well, you're absolutely correct there. So Cuba, if you're listening, well done. And just for anyone wondering, the song is playing in the background after the character Ray Boyd, who's like the little cute little kid, has his, like, did you know the human head weighs 8 pounds? Like, you know, I've been in the car when he's like saying all these like fun facts.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's
that, I think, I can, like, relate to that.
Wow. Renee Zellweger is like dropping Tom Cruise off at like an office or something, or okay. Anyway, it's like playing in the background. Yeah. And I kind of wish I didn't know this fact, because like next time I watch Jerry Maguire, I was just kind of hopeful that, like, I'd watch it and go, wait a minute, that's horses, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's kind of a shame to know the fact now. Anyway.
Oh, well.
All right, this is your last question. You're on 3 out of 4. In 2004, English leukemia survivor Lloyd Scott rode a penny farthing 4,300 kilometres across Australia, raising £60,000 for childhood cancer patients in the process. Within a range of 5 days, how long did it take him to complete the trip from Perth to Sydney on his penny farthing?
Penny farthing.
Yeah.
Wow.
The old-timey bikes.
Yeah. I hope you don't... we can't have too many Simpsons
references. Not too many Simpsons references.
on a penny farthing from Perth to Sydney.
Yeah.
The drive's like 3 days, like taking rests. So to the nearest 5 days, you said?
Nearest 5 days, yeah.
Oh, I'm going to go, it's a long time. I'm going to say around 95. Not round, but 95.
95?
Yeah.
So that would put you in a range of anywhere between 90 and 100.
Yeah.
Your DK?
Yeah.
Mate, I'm afraid he actually did it in 50 days.
What?
Which I reckon is pretty was good crack at it.
Did they check him for doping after that? That's incredible.
It was Lance Armstrong riding on a penny farthing. He rode up to 12 hours a day and celebrated the feat by dumping his penny farthing at Bondi Beach. Classic British people, no respect for Bondi Beach. Yeah. Scott has raised more than $5 million for charitable causes through various outlandish initiatives, including climbing Mount Kilimanjaro on a llama in 1997, and completing the world's first underwater marathon in a deep sea diving suit in Loch Ness, taking 12 days. He spent up to 4 hours a day underwater as part of that.
Wow.
Particular initiative. Yeah, you reckon that the chafing must have been pretty bloody painful.
Riding on a penny farthing
across Perth, Sydney.
I just think when it starts getting hilly, because you don't have any gears in a penny farthing.
Yeah, true, actually. I don't know if it was a modified one, perhaps.
Maybe, yeah. But
it kind of have to have been, right? Like, yeah, because if you're going up a hill in that thing, like, surely it actually can't really get up the hill.
I see how you could get, like, from Perth, just east of Perth to just west of Adelaide, but then it starts getting hilly.
Just flat, for sure.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was a pretty fair effort, to be honest.
Yeah, wow. That's good on him.
How long do you reckon you would take to do that?
On a penny farthing? Well, the first 50 days would be learning to ride a penny farthing.
That's it. It's actually quite hard to balance on, isn't it?
I've heard that.
Because the wheel's so large.
Yeah.
Like, you're not really at risk on a normal bike of just falling over because the wheel's so ungainly.
And if you brake, do you kind of just go, like, over the front wheel?
Yeah, I think you would. I don't know. Never ridden a penny farthing.
I'd give it a shot. You can see me riding a penny farthing, can't you?
I could see that.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so you've done very well there, mate, with 3 out of 5 in your first round outdated transport options.
Yep, excellent, excellent. Well, should we just crack straight into formerly known as?
Let's go.
What landlocked African nation was known as Upper Volta between 1958 and 1984?
I know this, actually.
Oh, really?
I do know this, yeah. I'm a big fan of, like, old country names. I don't know, I think it's kind of interesting. Like,
yeah.
There's some good ones as well. Like Zaire.
Zaire, is, yeah.
I think that's a really cool
name. That's African, yeah.
For, that's not this country, but no, the Republic of Upper Volta is now known as Burkina Faso, I'm pretty sure.
It is. And the capital, which you'd know the name of, actually was the capital of both countries as well.
Ouagadougou?
I don't know if that's how it's pronounced. Yeah. But, and it actually was independent from France for most of the time. It was known as Upper Volta, changing its name 24 years after gaining independence. Awesome. So, which major US airline, and I told you I was going to get some plane questions in, was founded in 1928 with the name Huff Daland Dusters? HUFF DALAND Dusters. Because they're a crop dusting company.
That sounds like a law firm. What is it? Huff Leyland Dusters?
Daland.
Huff Daland Dusters.
Yeah. It sounds like a law firm that also decided to have like a tongue twister as a name.
I think they always are kind of a bit tongue twisty.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. American airlines that were founded in the 1920s. Okay, so we've got literally American Airlines.
Yep.
We've got Pan American. We've got Delta. We've got Spirit. We've got...
I don't think Spirit's been around that long. I don't think low cost was really a thing in the 20s.
Well, to be fair though, I wouldn't want to hang too much if I'm flying in a crop duster plane. But I'm going to go with American Airlines, I think.
It's not one that you mentioned, it's Delta.
I said Delta, didn't I?
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. Well, it's one that you mentioned, it's Delta.
It's even worse if we mentioned it and didn't guess it.
They were actually founded in the state of Georgia, which I think just would have been way too much of a giveaway because Atlanta is like all over the city of... Delta is all over the city of Atlanta, and that's somewhere that Jasper and I have actually spent a bit of time.
Yeah, so that's where our dad lives. So yeah, probably would have been a bit of a giveaway. But there you go. Okay, so I've copped the L on that one.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
I'm sorry to hear. Okay. Next question. Okay. I love a royal question as well. We're going to find out. A royalty question. In 2020, Prince Andrew, not my favourite royal, resigned from all of his royal roles. Where was he the Duke of? And does he maintain that title despite leaving royal roles?
So this is a two-prong question, is it?
Yeah. Look, if you know where it's from and you get it wrong, I'm just curious to see what you think.
I should know this. And I do like a Prince Andrew question at trivia. not in some weird way. I just think like the whole BBC thing, if we can preserve that interview as much as possible.
Cinematic masterpiece.
Yeah. In trivia.
Yep.
I think we'll all be the better for it.
Mm-hmm.
Think of
all the dukes and duchesses and where they're from, and I reckon you'll not. Oh. Or just think of all the town names, because you'll know that there's a duke of this place.
I think he was the... Oh, no, he wasn't the Duke of... the grand old Duke of York. Maybe he was. I think he was definitely... yeah, I think he may have been the Duke of York, and I'm going to say that he does ceremonially still have that title, but he doesn't do anything anymore because it's too much of like a PR nightmare, like whatever he does, going everywhere, and he's causing everyone else to sweat with his antics, even though he is unable to sweat himself.
Very unsweaty man.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. A Pizza Express in Woking can attest to that. I'm going to say he's the grand old Duke of York, and he had 10,000 indiscretions. No, he's Duke of York, and he I think he still is, actually.
You are correct on both fronts there.
Get in.
Excellent.
All right, question four.
That wasn't even a formally known as question, really, because he's still known as the Duke of York.
Well, yeah, true. That was quite the opposite, if anything.
I know. That was double play from me. Okay. So, formally known as... Now, Jasper has got some sort of expertise on the subject of Australian sport.
I do like my sport.
And so, I've managed to inject a little bit of sporting history in Australia here. Which Geelong player... famously changed his name to Whiskers for 1 week in 1999 in order to raise an undisclosed amount for the then embattled Cats.
This is one of my favourite trivia facts.
Yeah.
And the reason was Geelong was so poor, the club.
$7.5 million in debt.
That Whiskers, for anyone who may not be aware, is a cat food company. Mm-hmm. And the Geelong Football Club is the Geelong Cats. Mm. So they were like, if you change your name by deed poll to Whiskers, you'll be able to, we'll give you all this money.
One round.
Yeah, which...
The amount of money was never known.
Yeah, which is still not known. Because I've actually read up on this recently-ish for trivia purposes. Because I just think it's a really fun fact. And I don't know. Like, we talk in sport a lot about going the extra mile for the team and doing it for the boys and stuff. Mate, this bloke nailed it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And, like, he literally, like, suffered the embarrassment and indiscretion of being named Whiskers for a week.
For a week.
Just so his club could be the better for it. And I think today's kids, that was me hitting the desk, could learn a lot from this.
Yeah.
From Gary Hocking was his name.
Correct.
Yes.
Very well done. Yep, Gary Hocking. 1 week, 1999, called Whiskers. I mean, you've given all of the context to it. I don't think we need to add any more.
So this is my final question. I think I'm...
You're on three from four.
Jeez, okay. It's just a high scoring
question. What did I got? I got three from
you're three five. Out of five. Okay. It's pretty good.
Well, I think you're going to get this last one. I intentionally have made this round a bit easier. We're going to warm up into some hard trivia.
Okay.
What one-hit rapper has the full name Robert Matthew Van Winkle?
I believe that this was star of That's My Boy, Vanilla Ice.
Correct.
Uncle Vanny.
I think that, like, you can use a lot of logic to work that out because both his rapper name, both his stage name and his birth name are both insanely white. Robert Van Winkle.
Is it Van Winkle, like vanilla? Is that why?
I thought Vanilla Ice was because he was white.
Oh, probably that probably makes more sense. Well, it's clever if it's got us thinking about it in multiple angles.
Oh, mate. He's always been one of those people that really makes you think, hasn't he?
Yeah, no one knows how deep this thing goes.
Yep.
Excellent. All right, so after one round, Harley's on 3 out of 5 and I am on 4 out of 5. So it's a tightly run affair going into round two.
Round two.
Okay, round two. Harley, your category for round two is non-standard meat choices.
Mm.
And what am I playing for?
You are playing for, I'll just get this up, big dogs.
Big dogs. Excellent. So, non-standard meat choices. You eat meat. So
I eat a lot of meat.
You do. Is this a way for you to expand your... Like, how have you palate?
Look, I didn't want something that I had to study a lot for. And I've come to the realization recently, I don't think there's a single food I don't like.
Really?
I don't like dill particularly, and I don't like coriander.
Okay.
But, you know, offal, any sorts of, like, I don't think I've eaten something that I don't particularly, that I wouldn't eat again. You know, there's nothing that's, like, induced a gag reflex in me.
What about when we were in Thailand and you ate, was it cockroaches we had, or like some sort of bug?
Yeah, well, I had bugs again when I was in Mexico last month. Yeah.
Craving it.
Delicious. Wow. I'll eat offal. I'll eat, and you know, I just feel like I naturally have got a lot more knowledge of non-standard meats than most people because I just don't say no to this kind of thing.
That was a tactical choice. All right. Well, question one then.
Mm.
The Swedish delicacy surströmming is often credited as the stinkiest food in the world. It is banned from flights by such airlines as Finnair, Air France, and KLM over fears of cans exploding on board.
Mm.
It's the subject of many YouTube reaction videos. And was even once at the center of a German court case when a tenant was evicted for spilling it in the common area of his apartment block. What kind of fermented meat is used to make surströmming?
Well, surströmming actually translates to sour this type of meat.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't have that in my little blurb of facts afterwards, but...
I see this, one of my very good friends, James, who... I'll see if he's going to listen to the first episode when I send it by giving him a shout out. And I have often said we want to give this a try. I know it's definitely a fish of some sort. It's a fermented fish. I believe it's fermented herring. And there's a fable about basically some traveling fishermen that sold their off fish to a village. And the next year when they came around, they expected to be, you know, accosted for it. But actually, they wanted to... The villagers wanted more of this fermented fish because it was so delicious.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. They're into the stinky fish.
Mm.
And it was stinky herring. Mm. So well done. I was going to give you half points for fish, but you don't even need it. You've gotten the full credit with herring. And you know what? This is exactly what you were hoping would come of this round.
Yeah.
Literally one question in, you were like, I want questions about stinky food or bad food or weird food because that's the kind of food I like.
For sure.
And it's planned out. So just on that court case, which I thought was the most interesting part here. When a tenant took his landlord to court for being evicted in 1981, the landlord's defence consisted of taking a can of surgery into the court and opening it.
Crazy.
The court ruled in favour of the landlord. And also, too, just in Surstrom's defence, because I feel like, you know, Surstrom, it's an inanimate object, so it doesn't have the ability to defend itself.
Mm.
But the people who defend Surstrom claim that the reason people find it gross is because they're not eating it properly, and the can should be opened underwater
yeah.
to combat the smell of the gases leaking too much. And the fish then needs to be gutted properly and ideally served with a Swedish flatbread called tunnbrod. Question two. The McDLT was an alternative to McDonald's standard beef burgers that came in a special styrofoam container designed to keep the beef hot on one side and the cold ingredients cold on the other side. Until they were combined. In 1985, which actor starred in the musical TV ad that introduced the McDLT before achieving worldwide fame in a television program that debuted 4 years later?
Yep.
Do you know the ad?
I know the ad.
Do you want to sing any of the jingle for us?
I don't know it that well.
McDLT.
Yeah, it's kind of like a semi-rap, isn't it?
Well, I don't want to give any too much away. I've already given you too much.
I implore anybody that hasn't watched it to go Google it and go find it. It features the man that most of us probably know as Seinfeld's, what would you use to describe him?
Lackey. Crony.
Played by Jason Alexander, I believe is the actor's name. And it's funny because he looks identical to how he does in Seinfeld.
He's a bit more suave in the McDLT ad, I have to say. Because he's kind of like dancing around and everyone's getting around him and want to hear all about the new McDonald's burger.
I don't know
that George Costanza has that kind of people power.
Yeah. I think... Well, can we give me the points for Jason Alexander?
It is Jason Alexander, correct.
I make it a do for myself. But he... maybe my head morphs it into just seeing George when I look at it. But it's kind of... It's like, it looks to me like a really lame, early middle-aged man dancing around and everyone thinking that it's cool, which is really, I think, the target demographic for McDonald's.
Possibly. He has a bit more hair in the McDLT ad than he does as George Costanza. But Jason Alexander's right. Modern viewers might be surprised to see Alexander sing and dance so competently in the ad. But
Broadway.
He actually, began his career as a stage actor, appearing in the original Broadway cast of the Stephen Sondheim musical Merrily We Roll Along in 1981. And he won the Tony for Best Performance by a Lead Actor in a Musical for Jerome Robbins' Broadway in 1989.
Wow.
So he's actually got some serious stage chops, old mate George.
Did you know that, I think it's in Melbourne, and I don't know if it's a bar or cafe or restaurant, there is a George Costanza-themed venue.
Really?
Yeah, it opened a couple of years ago.
Wow.
I think it's called George's Place. I'm going to get out my phone right now and check it.
What sort of stuff are we talking, like, how is it George themed? Is it sort of like his sort of aesthetic, or is it like sort of food?
This is the kind of thing that rocked up, like, in a news.com.au article that was suggested and was not clicked on.
Weird Seinfeld restaurant will make you cringe.
Something like that. George Costanza... Restaurant Melbourne, okay? We're not taking sponsored content at the moment, but yeah, George's Bar.
Wow.
Yep.
Can you describe it for the listeners, what you're seeing?
It's open apparently on Fridays and Saturdays only. The website says... Oh no, this is a broadsheet article. There are two quotes inscribed at the front door at George's Bar. It's not a lie if you believe it, and everyone must like me. I must be liked. Seinfeld fans will recall these classic lines from neurotic George Costanza, whose character inspired the tongue-in-cheek bar.
Wow. So is that the extent of the George Costanza
homage?
No, there's nothing else there.
I don't know. I'm not going to read a whole article.
That's all right. Fair enough. Reading is for chumps. All right. Question three. You're on 2 out of 2. In adapting Harry Harrison's 1966 science fiction novel Make Room for the screen in the 1970s, writers made several changes to the plot. The most notable addition... was a twist ending in which the lead character discovers a horrible secret about the mass-produced foodstuff that gives the film adaptation its title. What is that title?
Oh, I'm going to know this once you say it, but it's not going to come to me. There's countless Simpsons references to this, I swear.
Simpsons do love this.
I'm going to say, Cyber Chow or something, because I may as well not stab at it, but I think they give it like a groovy name. What is it?
It was people. Soylent Green Soylent was Green. People.
Ugh.
Yeah.
That's annoying. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It's referenced frequently on The Simpsons, but the plot of Make Room altered quite significantly. Essentially, it's a dystopian novel where the poor people in the society can only afford to purchase these wafers that are Soylent Red, Soylent something else, and then a new one comes out called Soylent Green that everyone enjoys so much more. But then this detective played by Charlton Heston realizes that it's been made from dead bodies.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Kind of dark.
Twist. Yeah.
If you're Harry Harrison in 1966, mate, what are you doing not making that part of the story?
I know.
A bit on that one, Harry.
It seems like a fairly large plot point to add to a film.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what happens in the end. They all live happily ever after in the book, maybe. Okay, so you've dropped one there. You're on 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
Question 4. Eggs are often used in place of meat as a source of protein for vegetarians. But in 2019, a 17-year-old Melburnian named William Connolly found a different use for the oval-shaped chicken deposit. Connolly made worldwide headlines for doing what with an egg? Keep it G-rated, please. Which was captured on film and earned him a notable nickname.
So, this is exactly the type of history that I've lived through, you know?
Yeah.
This is beautiful. He was Egg Boy.
That's the nickname. What did he actually do, though?
He egged, which is what you do with eggs. He smashed an egg on the scalp of Senator Fraser Anning at a party event, and then got hit by Fraser Anning, despite being a child.
Yeah, all of that is correct. The answer is egging Queensland Senator Fraser Anning after he made controversial comments about the Christchurch mosque shooting. That's the part people forget about it. He wasn't just some dumb teenager like chucking an egg at Fraser Anning. No. He was a political hero.
Yep.
Well, at least had a political stance. Connolly was cautioned for egging Anning at a far-right rally in Melbourne. Anning has actually since been declared bankrupt.
Yep.
Linked with his $185,000 debt to Bendigo Bank over a failed business project.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, do you remember when Egg Girl tried to egg Scott Morrison? I think it was in Albury.
It was Egg Girl as well.
Yeah, but the egg didn't actually break.
Oh, that's the one thing that I'm looking for out of someone egging a politician.
I know, like it was like, I don't know how you don't break an egg. Like, did she hard boil it beforehand?
Egg Girl. Good to see a bit of egg quality. So.
God, that'll have to get cut.
Goodness me, it's going to be people tuning out right now. Okay, the final question of non-standard meat choices. So you're on, again, you're on 3 out of 4. So you're on track to do quite well again here, mate.
Mm-hmm.
Question 4. The party game Chubby Bunny does not involve eating rabbit, but rather stuffing as many marshmallows as possible in one's mouth, with the most prolific marshmallow stuffer deemed the winner. The game dates back to at least a 1959 Peanuts comic strip, but is also thought to have been popularised by its appearance in which Australian children's book series and its spin-off American TV show. Each entry into the book series comprises short stories that detail the protagonist, a young boy, engaging in stupid, disgusting, or otherwise crazy activities.
This is like Paul Jennings or Andy Griffith. I remember this particular short story. And I think they were called... I might be getting wise crossed, but I think they were called like Just Stupid and Just Incredible, or like Just, and I think they were called the Just series. I don't know if the protagonist's name was Justin or something like that, but from memory, this story, like, he gets tickled and like basically spurts it everywhere, or has to laugh at like a family or populated event, and like, anyway, there ends up being marshmallow flying. But I think it's called the Just series.
The Just series is correct, Matt. Well done.
Awesome.
Just by Andy Griffiths, you said. There's an American TV show spin-off of that, which
really?
I absolutely did not realise until I was researching this question.
Wow.
And just some marshmallow-related facts for everyone. Wikipedia claims the person who holds the record for this game had 69 marshmallows in their mouth, but I don't know about that. I think that's just someone who's mates with that guy taking a piss on Wikipedia. And as a side note, the record for most marshmallows eaten in 1 minute is only 25, which I reckon is very beatable.
Oh, yeah.
Guinness World Record, 25.
Are you allowed to lubricate them on the way down?
I think that's probably the crucial thing, isn't it? You wouldn't want like the marshmallows to be that dust. Like, you know how marshmallows get a bit powdery, dusty? You wouldn't want that.
Mm, no, 25, jeez.
So you're going at what? One marshmallow every 2 and a bit seconds. Right? Is that the math's on that, right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
I feel like that's quite doable. But you know what? You'd need to start strong, I reckon, because I reckon you'd inevitably taper off a bit.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And like you say, like the marshmallow dust would get caught in your throat. Mm.
Yeah, yeah, wow. There you go.
25. Maybe in the next episode we can do a podcast version of breaking that record. Well, you finished round two, non-standard meat choices, with an incredible 4 out of 5. Mm-hmm. So you're currently on 7 out of 10.
Wow.
You're doing very well here, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
My turn for round two. What have you got in store in Big Dogs?
Now, taking it pretty literally, the Rhodesian Ridgeback is an interbreed of African and European canines, which had the initial role of assisting in the hunting of what animal in the Cape Colony?
The Cape Colony.
In the Cape Colony.
Like in South Africa?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. The Rhodesian Ridgeback is its name.
Okay, what kind of animals... I've heard of a Rhodesian Ridgeback, but they're looking to either hunt it, either probably to eat it, or because it's vermin and is destroying their crops, I would imagine. It's one of those two things, probably. Yeah.
I would more picture, like, hunting something, like, there's lots of hunting that's not for practical reasons, purely for enjoyment or for, like, you know.
Oh, just for fun?
Yeah, or, like, I mean, people, like, poaching, hunting, all that, like, all that kind of thing. It's not specifically, like, yeah, maybe pragmatic.
I don't know too much about hunting, as is being shown here. I don't really know, to be honest. I'm gonna say, like, maybe like some sort of small like birds or something that they hunt, and like the dog sort of helps sniff it out, and then the birds fly up and they can shoot them or something like that.
Okay.
I'm gonna say, small fowl.
Believe it or not, the Rhodesian Ridgeback was supposed to assist in the hunting of lions.
Lions?
Lions.
Mate, if you're a dog, you're a bit stitched up by that, aren't you?
I know. I mean, like, yeah.
Isn't the whole point that if you're a hunting dog, you hunt stuff that you're bigger and stronger than?
I don't know. Assisting in the hunting was how it was written. But I amazing, right? It's quite a large dog.
Okay, 0 for 1. Got to bounce back here.
So, to the nearest 100 feet... how large is the world's largest hot dog ever? Made in Flensburg, Germany in 2017.
To the nearest 100 feet.
To the nearest 100 feet.
Oh, this has got to be... I reckon this is the kind of thing that you could make it quite large, because it could just be really slender.
Yeah.
Like, also too, do you know how like Frankfurters, like when they're on like a chain? Mm. If you counted that as the one hot dog, you could just keep on going and going and going.
I think there was bread and condiments with this one.
Yeah, no, for sure. But like, I just mean that...
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know, it's not like the largest steak of all time that it's like, well, no, like, Mother Nature is putting probably limits on how big that could be.
Mother Nature's got nothing to do with hot dog, does it?
Hot dogs defy Mother Nature at every turn and with every bite. Yeah, I think I'm gonna think it's quite big. Mm. And to the nearest 100 feet makes me think that it's like, yeah, in the thousands of feet, potentially. No, but see, the thing is, though, you've got to have some sort of machine that makes this hot dog. So,
yeah. Have you ever seen someone make sausages, though?
Yeah. Oh, with, like, a sausage skin and stuff and, like, you...
Yeah.
The casing. You put the stuff in the casing.
As in for cooking it.
Is that what you mean? Like, making a sausage?
Yeah. Now I think about it, like, yeah, the cooking of it would be the real... Like, the construction of it. How do you...
Was this hot dog edible? Did they eat it?
I think they did, yeah.
Really? Okay, well, I'm going to say it's a few hundred feet at least. I'm going to say it was 800 feet long. Which is how many meters?
800 feet would be just under 300 meters long.
I could, mate. It's the longest in the world.
Ever. Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to say 800 feet.
Man, you are like painfully close.
Oh, no.
It's 700 feet to the nearest 100 feet.
Oh.
I know. And it was this record they've been repeatedly trying, like breaking since 2001. It was just over 700 feet. I think it was about 712 feet.
Okay.
Should I Google that? Or like, I mean, Google it if you're really interested in large hot dogs.
We're all interested in large hot dogs, mate.
Don't Google large hot dogs.
Not at work.
Okay.
Are you a mustard on the hot dog sort of? What do you have on the hot dog?
I honestly like everything about hot dogs, but the hot dog itself.
Well, that means the condiments are all the more important because you just got to case it in.
I don't think I'd have a hot dog out of choice. If like it was the only thing like available, I would have loads of sauerkraut.
Yeah.
Lots of mustard.
Mm.
Bit of ketchup. Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. I think the mustard's... the hero of the dish in a way. And then like a little sliver of ketchup. Like it can't be like, I don't think they're, the ratio is not 1-to-1. I don't know.
Yeah. Look, if I was in New York and they were selling them on the side of the road, I would get one, you know, because I'm in New York and that's how I'd do it. I would have a lot of mustard, a lot of sauerkraut and a bit of ketchup.
I've got leftover childhood trauma from AMF bowling at Castle Hill where we grew up. The hot dogs, like, used to have them and, like, throw up that night. Like, I remember there were, like, a few times I had the bowling hot dogs and got really sick. And I don't know what, like, now that I'm an adult and understand, like, food preparation standards and stuff a bit better, I don't know what was going on in that kitchen that a few times the AMF bowling hot dogs made you throw up.
Well, maybe you're, like, allergic to some sort of meat that is only found in hot dogs.
I'm allergic to raccoon meat. Oh, no.
For less than a week in November 2023, so like the month that this is being recorded, perhaps the world's biggest dog, Snoop Dogg, announced he was giving up weed.
Yeah.
How many days was it before he admitted that it was a publicity stunt? It was less than a week.
Less than a week.
It was less than a week.
Okay. Well, I've got a 1 in 6 chance then, or unless it was 0 days, so a 1 in 7 chance.
Yeah, I don't think it'd be trivia if it was like psych at the end of the video.
Yeah. He's got to do it a few days to let the publicity like sort of. It can't be like one day. So I'm gonna say that he waited 4 days before he told everyone.
4 days is correct. Yes. Yeah. 16th to the 20th of November, the world thought Snoop Dogg was giving up. You know what defines him as a man.
Jeez. World's gone mad.
Yep. He was actually, it was part of a promotion with Solo Stove.
All right, so I'm on the board with 1 out of 3 for big dogs. Let's go, question 4.
Okay, Pitbull often refers to himself as Mr. Worldwide. He's also known to refer to himself as Mr. Watt, which is the original zip code for Miami, Dade County.
Well, I believe he went from Mr. This to Mr. Worldwide to show, to elucidate his rise to stardom, as it were. I believe this was Mr. 305.
Ding, ding, ding.
There was a barista at the cafe at uni who looked a lot like Pitbull, and we used to call him Barista Worldwide.
To his face?
No, absolutely not. But he even had like a little soul patch and stuff. He looked a lot like Pitbull.
Well, see, that the Cuba Gooding Jr. story, which we all know now.
Yeah.
He, the guy that I was with, who my photo with Cuba Gooding Jr. is with, was roughly the age of Pitbull. And, like, I got talking to him, and he reckoned that he went to school and was a few years younger than Pitbull. But I feel like that's the kind of thing you say if you're from Miami and you're vaguely that age.
Wait, so he was just saying, like, oh, yeah, like, we'd be about the same age, so we'd probably... Is that what he meant?
No, no, he was like, I went to school with Armando.
Oh.
His
name Armando.
Yeah, his name's Armando Perez.
Oh, that's a cool name. Why'd you change it? Well, just Armando would have been good.
He could be Armando, Mr. Worldwide, Mr. 305, or Pitbull.
Yeah, Mr. Perez.
Yeah, he's one of those people that quite often appears on lists of nice guy celebrities.
Really?
Yeah, have you ever, like...
Adam Sandler's always on those.
Yeah. Hugh Jackman's always on those. But Pitbull quite often appears on them.
There you go.
Yeah. Have you seen the... I can't remember where it is, but it's somewhere like... in Alaska, it's at a Walmart, and it's like Walmart store number, I think it's might be number 305, Kodak, Alaska, would love a visit from Pitbull. It's all of the stuff I was holding, and then the next photo is Pitbull with all the stuff.
Oh, that's so good. Wait, it was in Alaska?
Yeah, like it was a middle of nowhere store.
He flew there just to get a photo, maybe.
I don't know, maybe he was, I mean, he's Mr. Worldwide. Like, he might have just been in the area.
You got to live up to the name. But
I think it was store number 305, and perhaps that was kind of memed on.
Yeah, do you reckon people ever call him and he's just like on a tour of duty around the world trying to be as worldwide as possible? It's like, oh, sorry, mate, I can't talk. I'm just in French Guiana or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because there's a certain sort of pedigree, a certain sort of weight that comes with being... Mr. Worldwide.
I know.
If you're really going to live up to it.
Must be tiring.
It's a full-time job.
The 1971 hit Joy to the World by Three Dog Night starts with what nonsensical opening amphibious line?
Opening amphibious line.
I
believe this was related to a certain bullfrog and the extent to which he may or may not have been a friend of mine.
Yeah, well, I'm going to need the line thing.
Was it Jeremiah was a bullfrog? Was a good friend of mine.
Yep.
Is that it?
That's it.
Okay.
You can do more if you'd like.
I never understood a single word he said, but I helped him drink his wine. And you know what?
Yeah.
If you're saying that Jeremiah was a bullfrog, like maybe let's not have a crack at other people about not understanding what they're saying.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It sounds like you're pretty fucking full of shit yourself.
I don't know how much swearing we're going to get away with in this podcast.
Yeah, true, actually. I think that's our first one. We've gone 50-something minutes.
I think I said the F word earlier.
Okay.
I said something vaguely wrong. But yeah, you're right. Jeremiah was a bullfrog and he was a good friend of mine. I wonder what they did to like not be good friends anymore. Do you reckon they had like a punch on after a few wines?
I'd love to see. after sharing the wine a little too liberally, they stopped being friends.
Excellent.
Maybe Jeremiah died.
So, after a slowish start,
yep.
You've ended up with 3 from 5 there.
Sweet, okay.
So for round 3, Holly, you've chosen the category Mysterious Events, and I've chosen With Hilarious Consequences.
Round 3.
All right, Mysterious Events, question 1. In 2014... English author Russell Edwards claimed mitochondrial DNA found on the scarf of a murder victim proved that which infamous historical figure was in fact a Polish immigrant named Aaron Kosminski. The timing of Minsky being committed to a mental institution in 1891 had previously linked him in some people's eyes as the possible identity of this person. 1891, he was committed to a mental institution.
I'm quite confident at this.
Really?
You and I both have always loved our unsolved mysteries and our research into this kind of thing. I believe this is Jack the Ripper, the Whitechapel murderer.
The answer is, in fact, Jack the Ripper. Critics say the evidence is not strong enough to declare once and for all that the case is closed. While Kosminski had long been considered a suspect, there was no DNA evidence linking him to the crimes until testing was carried out on the shawl that was found next to the murdered body of Catherine Eddowes, who was one of the Ripper's victims.
Mm-hmm.
Mitochondrial DNA that was found on the shawl was a match with a living descendant of Kosminski, who was committed to a mental asylum roughly at the same time that Jack the Ripper murders stopped.
Yes.
So that's why people thought that maybe he might have been involved.
Yeah. Was he a butcher?
I'm not sure. I think some records list him as being a barber.
A barber.
But
okay.
I don't know if that's actually confirmed.
Right, okay.
Because it was a really long time ago and he's just some random immigrant dude. Like, there wouldn't really be much written about him. Question 2. You're doing well. Question 2. When short on clues to a body's identity, scientists are able to analyze levels of carbon-14 molecules in the corpse's teeth to determine its age, provided the person was born after 1955, when which events began to alter the levels of C14 in the atmosphere.
Of carbon-14?
Carbon-14 molecule. Bit of a science question.
What event in 55?
Yeah, it's... I'll just read it again.
Oh, I think I know what this would be.
Which events began to alter?
Events.
More than one.
Well, 55. See, carbon-14, it's to do with, like, radioactive decay, I'm pretty sure, carbon dating. But 45...
I was born after 1955.
55. See, 45 was like nuclear bombing. But I reckon the Russians went crazy about nuclear testing in the 50s for the Cold War. And I think the Tsar bomber, which was the biggest ever, which like punched a hole through like the bounds of the atmosphere, really, was probably around then. So I'm going to say nuclear testing, specifically probably Russian nuclear testing.
The answer I've got here is above ground nuclear testing. Well done. One study found precision is highest in individuals born in the 1960s and 1970s, given a moratorium was put on the testing in 1964. So that was therefore when the levels of C14 started to drop. So it's easier to be more specific because it's clear before and after.
That's amazing that, you know, some 70 years later on the other side of the world, it would still be like enough to be in our teeth.
Yeah. Question 3. The String of Pearls, which is the first literary work to feature the character Sweeney Todd, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, the novel that inspired the iconic Western film of the same name, and the epic poem Beowulf, all have what in common as far as mysteries go?
Huh. And the topic is...
Mysterious events.
Mysterious events.
What do they all have in common as far as mysteries are concerned?
I reckon... I reckon this isn't the kind of thing I want to be able to just kind of triangulate and deduce. I reckon it's got something to do with the author, and I reckon it might be they preceded the unexplained death or disappearance of the author.
Okay. Is that what you're looking in with?
That's what I'm going to lock in, yeah.
You're pretty close because it does have something to do with the author. They're all written by unknown authors or authors whose identities are disputed. So The String of Pearls was a Penny Dreadful, which is essentially a sort of really cheap... cheap book. Is sort of, I was going to say, like, hammed up, quite sort of like melodramatic sort of lowbrow sort of fiction that was published by Edward Lloyd, who did not permit authors to be credited for their works on the book. It's thought to have been written by one or both of James Malcolm Rymer or Thomas Peckett Prest, but both other names have been suggested and neither really has been confirmed unanimously. The Treasure of the Sierra Madre is attributed to a German writer using the pseudonym B. Traven, but the author's actual identity is not known. And the author of the Old English poem Beowulf is not known, but it's believed to have been written prior to the year 1000.
Wow. Wow.
So there you go. Kind of interesting there.
That's very interesting.
Unknown authors.
For sure.
All right, so you're on 2 out of 3 for this round. Question number 4. From the early 1980s, plastic phones shaped like which cartoon character began washing up on beaches near Brittany, France? This character has been syndicated nationally in America since 1978, only a handful of years before the phone started appearing, but did not make his feature film debut until 2004.
2004?
Yep.
Wow, okay. See, I know this because this is the kind of thing that floats around on the same parts of the internet as I do.
Really?
Yeah. This is awesome. It's a character who would rather pig out than work out. He's not very fond of Mondays, and he does enjoy quite a good lasagna, I understand.
Are you this bloke's PR agent? How do you know so much about him?
I actually know that from Mike Pence when he was a member of the Indiana Congress, I believe. He actually made a speech in Congress to wish Garfield a happy birthday. Have you seen this?
No.
Okay, we'll watch it afterwards. But yeah, it's incredible. It is incredible. It's the Garfield phone beach, right?
Like,
there's a submerged shipping container that has been like disintegrating and letting all of these Garfield phones wash up.
So you're 100% correct, and you've got some of the explanation here. In 2019, journalists and members of a French environmental group located the source of the Garfield phones once and for all. It was a sea cave only accessible at low tide. They thought the phones came from a shipping container that washed up into the cave after a storm.
Mm.
And this is a quote from one of the environmental visitors. I saw Garfield and container pieces all over the cave. The bulk of the phones are already gone. The sea has done its job for 30 years. We arrive after the battle. Which I've got to say...
very poetic.
As far as quotes about phones with Garfield on them in a beach in France, that's very poetic. French. According to France Info, as many as 200 Garfield phones were found on French beaches in 2018 alone.
Wow.
Yeah. Don't know that they'd be much use after they've been sitting in a cave for 40 years, but...
yep.
Question 5. This is your last one, and you're on 3 out of 4 here in Mysterious Events, so you're going really well.
Wow.
Question 5. In 2016, a biologist with the surname Orchid replaced an elderly housekeeper as a suspect in the murder of which person, for whom there were at the time 5 other suspects?
2016.
A biologist with the surname Orchid.
That's a good surname for a biologist. That's a good surname for a biologist. So you didn't tell me when the murder occurred, but in 2016 there were 5 suspects.
5 other suspects.
Okay. If there were 5 at the time, I'm going to guess that it's either solved or there's like 1 or 2 these days. And so it's probably pretty famous. And maybe slightly outdates DNA, or like slightly outdates DNA just being so good, or like databasing being so good. I'm going to guess that this unsolved murder, which was in the 90s, which you may or may not be familiar with, well, I mean, if it's the answer, you will be, might have something to do with. Is it the murder of JonBenet Ramsey?
It's actually the murder of Mr. Body in Cluedo.
I don't want to do the podcast with you anymore.
No, okay. So
who did he replace?
The elderly housekeeper.
Miss White.
Dr. Orchid replaced Mrs. White as the suspect. The 6 well-known Cluedo characters are Mr. Green, Professor Plum, Colonel Mustard, Miss Peacock, Mrs. White, and Miss Scarlet. But at times, other characters have briefly been introduced. A Southern belle named Miss Peach, a con artist named Monsieur Brunette, and a fortune teller named Madame Rose are among the other characters that have appeared in various iterations of the game, which was first published in 1943.
I think we need a TikTok so you can see how disappointed my face is right now, audience. I don't know.
It's an interesting fact.
It's an interesting fact for sure. Well, JonBenet Ramsey's family were very wealthy, so I figure they might have a housekeeper, but there you go. Okay. The Cluedo house definitely does have it. And for the record, and just so you feel the amount of disappointment I did, I never enjoyed playing Cluedo as a kid.
Yeah, you did definitely hate it.
I hated
it. Roped into playing it a lot because it needs three people.
Harley Bruce with the rope at the table playing Cluedo.
Also, yeah. Too, for any American listeners, Mr. Black in Clue is also an acceptable answer. Mr. Body is what he's called in the British version, and it's Mr. Black in the American one. All right, heading into my final category for round three.
Hilarious consequences. Kyle Edward Craven's 2005-2006 yearbook photo was posted on Reddit in January 2012 and quickly took hold as what sensational meme?
I believe... Is this a certain man known for not having very much luck and for wearing a sweater? Could it possibly be Bad Luck Brian?
You are correct. It is Bad Luck Brian. It was posted by one of his friends.
Oh, jeez. That's very bad luck to have your friend backstab you like that.
And I don't know if you found it funny or not, but Kyle Craven's now 34 years old. And I've seen photos of him. He's not. He looks like a bit of luck has come to him.
Really?
Well, I mean, he doesn't look like he looked in the photos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think he's made money out of it?
I don't know if being a meme is particularly lucrative.
But if there's official Bad Luck Brian merchandise, surely people out there would pay for that.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Stopping you, though, I guess, from just like taking that image off Facebook and making a shirt?
Yeah, it might not be as lucrative as it once was as well.
There's just not the money in memes like there used to be.
The men's marathon at what city's Olympics is often quoted as the most bizarre Olympic event in history due to only 14 contestants of 34 finishing, with some suffering strychnine poisoning, the original winner having been driven part of the way in a car, and the fourth place contestant having found time to take a nap mid-event.
I think this is going to be one of the early Olympics. It's got to be like Athens, it had a really early one. St. Louis had a really early one. Off the top of my head, can't think which ones were going on in the early... I think I've heard of this. I reckon it could potentially be the St. Louis Olympics. So that's what I'm going to go for.
You're correct. It was the St. Louis Olympics. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Was it 1900 or 1896 Olympics around then?
1904.
Sorry, yeah. Okay.
So the guy that took a nap actually was a Cuban. He was a postman, and this was in the amateur days, and he had nothing to do with the Cuban Olympic team at all. He'd made his own way there via New Orleans, where he'd actually lost all of his money gambling and then didn't have enough food before the race. And so what he did was he came upon an apple tree and ate the apples, but apparently the apples made him somewhat sick because they're a bit rotten, and so he had to have a lie down and have a nap, and he still ended up coming fourth.
Wow.
And then the dude mysteriously vanished. None of his family or his work could contact him. And the next time he was seen was at the next Olympics.
Whoa.
He just made his own way. I think it was to Athens the next one. Like, I'm pretty sure at least one of them he arrived, like, on a fishing boat that he'd basically stowed away himself on. Very mysterious man. I can't remember his name, but...
That's awesome.
The South African runners were in St. Louis for the World Expo, for the World Fair. And they finished, but they were run miles off course by rabid dogs. The heat index for the day, it was because it was so humid, it was the equivalent of running like 35 degrees. And there was a dust storm at the time as well.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, horrible.
Wow. Well, what a difficult turn of events. A real marathon to get through that one.
So, Lou Pye, an executive at what firm, was forced to sell over $250 million in shares as part of his divorce due to infidelities with a stripper. Shortly before, this energy and commodity superpower collapsed into bankruptcy, famously in December 2001.
2001, okay. I was thinking maybe something like around the GFC time was when this might have happened, but that obviously rules that out. 2001, okay, well, Are we thinking energy super? So energy superpowers.
Energy commodity. They did a lot of things, but it was all in a very like industrial space. It's an American
company. Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to get this, to be honest. Like stuff like General Electric or any like big company like that I would have maybe heard of is from like American company. They're still going, I guess. I think I'm going to have to pass on this one. I'm going to say John Smith Electric.
The company was Enron.
Okay, I haven't heard of that.
You haven't heard of Enron?
No, so what more fun facts can you tell me about this specific event?
Well, they limped on for a number of years because, you know, you can file bankruptcy and, like, debt restructure there. They ended up closing around the time of the GFC. But Lou Pye is now one of the largest landowners in Colorado.
Wow.
Yeah, so he had to leave Enron, and I think his whole business thing, but I'm pretty sure he's either a billionaire or very close to a billionaire these days.
Everything's turned all right for Lou. And, yeah. And his now stripper wife, I presume?
Well, he got married shortly after that divorce, and so
To the stripper?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he got a pregnant.
Wow, I was kidding, but...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she ended up pregnant.
Love wins.
Yeah,
wow.
I know.
I've just crunched the numbers here. For me to win the game,
mm-hmm.
I gotta get both these questions right.
Okay.
Because you finished on 10 out of 15, and I'm currently on 9 out of 15.
So after losing to Lennox Lewis, which famous boxer said that he guessed he was just going to fade into Bolivian as a result in the early 2000s.
I think I've heard this quote, and I think when I think like boxers, I think I need to imagine this quote in a lisp, perhaps.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
He's just going to fade into Bolivian.
Yeah, yeah.
I reckon this could potentially be Michael Mike Tyson.
Iron Mike is correct.
Yeah, excellent. The star of The Hangover Part 1.
Yep, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. He's famous for his dogberry-isms, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what they're called? Like dogberry from Much Ado About Nothing.
It's an acceptable word. It's a perfectly cromulent word.
Perfectly cromulent. Okay.
Okay. So this is to win the game, is it?
Yeah, so we're already tied, and this is the shot to potentially take it out.
Okay. Jean-Claude Van Damme. Wham Bam Van Damme. He, as you may know him.
I do know him as that.
Confidently rejected a $36 million paycheck for 3 films as he pegged his value per movie to which 1990s comedy star. And he himself admits that his career has never fully recovered from that decision.
So what? He was like in a meeting and he was like, no.
On the phone?
He was on the phone and he's like, oh, this bloke makes $36 million every year or...
No, he was offered $36 million for 3 films.
Okay.
And he said, no, well, XYZ earns, and I think the number was like $20 million a film. That's my quote.
Wow.
And like hung up the phone and the phone never rang again.
There you go. I think, well, who's a big... This is the 90s.
90s, yep.
Yeah, I reckon this has got to be... I think this has got to be Jim Carrey. Who's the biggest comedy actor? Jim Carrey, Eddie Murphy's maybe a bit... Before then was when he was doing a lot of his best work. When I think iconic, highly paid 90s comedic actor, I think Jim Carrey. And I think that's what I'm going to lock in to potentially win the game on Trivia Champ or Trivia Chump. I'm locking it in.
Congratulations, Jasper. It is Jim Carrey.
Oh, James Carrey. You've saved the day.
Wow.
Jasper, you are the champ. Harley. You are the chump.
So that concludes today's episode of Trivia Champ or Trivia Chump. Thank you so much for listening. Please check us a follow on social media. We'll put the links in the description of the episode. And as we're a new podcast, we'd really love it if you could tell all your friends who are interested in trivia all about us, because that's the way we're going to hopefully grow a bit of a listener base. Harley, do you have any final words for the listeners today?
Not sure I do. So I guess I'm just going to fade into Bolivian then.
See you there. Thanks for listening, guys.
Trivia is the real winner here. I think we can all agree.